Good morning. Thank you all for coming today for what I think you're going to enjoy very much. My name is Josh Wheeler. I am the director of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. We are the host of this program today. It's a source of great pride for us at the center that this is the 22nd Virginia Festival of the Book. And the center has been involved in one way or another with all 22 festivals. And it's something that we hope to continue to do for many years to come, because I think one of the best ways to combat censorship or the desire to censor a speech we don't like is to remind people of the many benefits that we receive from free speech. And by having this kind of festival celebrating the right of free speech is, I think, a way to remind folks, well, it's a small price to pay when sometimes we have to hear some things that we might not want to hear, for all the benefits of being able to explore any idea, any theme, any concept without any fear of government reprisals. So, there we go. She knows this.
Applause for the First Amendment.
Now, I know that 22 years, it was actually in this very room that I discovered that I needed to wear glasses, because at some point, I don't know, it was three or four festivals in, I found myself doing this number. You know, they asked me to read some housekeeping details at the beginning, and so I brought this up, and then
person in the front row
I got that far,
it,
so you'll have to ask me, be patient with me with my glasses on. But I do want to tell you that this is the Virginia Festival of the Book, obviously, which is the product of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. I've been asked to ask everybody in the audience to please silence their cell phones, not just for us, but this is going to be recorded. And if you would like to tweet about this event, you can do so at hashtag VABook2016. And I say that as if I have any idea what it means.
And if you're going to tweet about this event, include me. I am at Kelly_Carlin, please.
She could be speaking a foreign language right now. I have no idea. Actually, I know a little bit about that. So Kelly's actually a very proficient tweeter with quite a number. How many followers do you have now?
Almost 30,000.
Wow. So, supporting the festival. The festival is free of charge, not free of cost. Please remember to go online and give back or pick up a giving envelope from the information desk at the Omni and support your festival so we may sustain it for many more years to come. Evaluations. Please fill out program evaluations. These provide useful information that help keep the festival free and open to the public. You can fill out a paper evaluation before you leave or complete it online at vabook.org/survey. I do know what that means. After this event, after the end of this program, we are going to have books available for sale right down here, and I think we could prevail upon our guest, our author, to sign a copy if you'd like.
I think that'll be happening.
Okay.
Yes.
We are here today to talk about this book, A Carlin Home Companion, Growing Up with George. And we will talk a little bit about that in the future. As I said, the center's been involved in many of these programs in the past, and I've had the great pleasure to moderate them, a number of them. I realize, though, probably about the third or fourth time, that people weren't here to hear me. They were actually more interested in hearing about the book or the author. And so I have learned that the best questions actually come from the audience itself. So I am going to, very early on, stop asking the questions and make the microphone available to you folks, and we'll bring the microphone around to anybody who has a question. I told Kelly that I can ask questions if this audience doesn't have any, but I have never found that to be a problem with Charlottesville audience.
And I can blah 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 as much
she go
as I
on
want
for anyone. But let me tell you a little bit about our author today. Kelly Carlin has written for film, TV, and most recently the stage, her critically acclaimed solo show, A Carlin Home Companion. Her master's degree in counseling psychology from Pacifica Graduate Institute informs her work as an author, speaker, workshop leader, and citizen of Earth. She lives in Los Angeles with her husband, Bob McCall, and their Jack Russell Terrier, Stella, but dreams of living somewhere with a lot fewer cars someday. And as long as you avoid 29 North, I think Charlottesville fits that bill perfectly. Will you please join me in welcoming Kelly Carlin from Los Angeles? I should also say, very, very proud of the fact that Kelly Carlin is on the Thomas Jefferson Center's Board of Trustees.
Very so happy to be a member.
A strong believer in free speech.
Yes.
And we're thrilled to have her to help direct the center's efforts. But first question.
Yes.
What compelled you to write your book?
Well, it's interesting. I've been wanting to write and tell my story for about 15, well, now that would be 17 years. It's funny how that does, the time thing does that like that. My mom died in 97, and after she died pretty suddenly, pretty quickly, diagnosed with liver cancer, was dead 5 weeks later. Pretty shocking. Huge wake-up call for me as a human, as an artist, as all sorts of things. And I'd had this wild and crazy life. I was 34, 35 at that time, and I felt like I'd already had lived seven lives. And I wanted to tell my story, my survivor story, because at 35, I was a very different person than I was at 25 or at 20 or at 15 or at 10. I mean, there was just so many different iterations of my life with my family and then my life as an adult, or what I was pretending to be an adult, at least. And so I wanted to tell my survivor's story. And I knew that, yeah, okay, so it's a little hook there, a little interesting. I happen to be George Carlin's daughter. And yes, part of my story is quite fun with my dad and my mom in the 60s and the 70s and in the 80s and all the way through till my dad's death. But I had, you know, my parents had drug and alcohol issues when I was a child until I was 12. My mother was an alcoholic. She almost died. She got sober. There was a lot of money and cocaine and fame in my house, so all the weird stuff that comes along with that, some great stories around that, which maybe we'll share today. And so I'd lived through that. Our family had lived through that. My father's heart disease, my mother's breast cancer. I'd gotten involved in some abusive relationships, my own drug addiction, panic attack syndrome. I'd been through a lot of stuff. And I felt like because I had gotten through it and found a way to get my feet back on the ground and find my center finally, that I really wanted to share that with the world. I wanted to, I don't know, pay it forward in some way. I was so lucky to grow up in the family that I grew up, even though it was pretty chaotic for quite a few years. But I understood my privilege. And so I wanted to share that. I wanted to share, as they say in AA, your experience, strength, and hope. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to write the book. Now that I've written it and I've been sitting with it and kind of looking back on it and talking a lot about it the last 5 or 6 months, I also see that being an only child, growing up in the shadow of fame, growing up in a family where the adults' chaos was in charge of my life until I was 12 years old, I didn't feel like I had a real voice or a place in the world. And I see now that telling my story is a way for me to heal that ultimately, to say, I exist, I'm here, I matter, like we all do. Every single one of us has a story to tell. And so I can see that on some level that there's that issue. That's one of the themes in the book. Invisibility, visibility is one of the themes I talk about. And I see now that that's part of it too. It's just something about being seen and heard, which all children want ultimately. So here I am being seen and heard big time.
Well, I want this program to be very much about your book, because it's a fascinating book, as you say, a survivor's tale. But a big part of that, of course, is your parents.
Yes.
And you're a writer. You've written for stage, for screen, for publication.
Yes.
And I can only assume that you inherited that in some part from your father, who loved the written word, who
actually
loved
inherited
language.
Inherited from the Carlin family itself.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Did that start with your father, or there's a great story in the book about perhaps where he got his love of words and language?
Yeah, I have to find out where that story is. But Carlin family were Irish, gift of the gab, and all that stuff. My dad's father, Patrick Carlin. My dad didn't really know his father. His father couldn't metabolize ethanol very well, as my father used to say. And when he wasn't drinking, he was a brilliant man. He was a big advertising guy in New York City, sold advertising for all the big papers, like national level salesman, brilliant salesman, and also won speaking contests, Dale Carnegie and stuff like that, national speaking awards, had a real gift for it. My dad never knew him, though, because his mother, my dad's mother, Mary, when my dad was about 3 months old, took my father and his older brother, Patrick, and snuck down the fire escape because she was tired of being battered around by Patrick Sr. And Patrick Sr. had started battering around young Patrick, too, and she wanted to protect my father from that. So there was the gift of the gab from that. And then Mary was an amazing storyteller. She was someone who would take a bus ride downtown and back uptown and have a full story about who was on the bus, beginning, middle, and end, punchline, the whole thing. Really a very funny, witty woman. And there's a little story here of my dad. Here, I'll just read a little bit of this. On May 12th, 1937, George Dennis Patrick Carlin was born. 8 weeks later, after months of trying to make the marriage work, Mary sneaked out the fire escape in the middle of the night with her two young boys, leaving Patrick Carlin Sr. and his rage for good. She'd seen the damage that her husband had already done to little Patrick, and she was not going to let sweet George be another victim. This time it stuck. She'd tried to leave him a few times before. Even though Patrick tried to woo her back, she held strong. George never saw his dad again. In 1945, his father died of a massive heart attack at the age of 57. My dad was 8 years old. Without a man around to keep my dad out of trouble on the streets of the Upper West Side of Manhattan, or what he and his friends like to call Irish Harlem, Mary took her job as both mother and father very seriously. She looked for ways to shape and control young George's mind and life. She succeeded in only one area, a love of language and words. Mary encouraged my dad to look up words he didn't know in the dictionary and then use them in conversation. One morning, young George, wanting to show off a new word he had learned, excitedly asked his mother if she had perused the paper that morning. He anticipated her approval. Slowly she turned, sharpened her gaze onto him, and said, "I have not. Actually, I've only given it a cursory glance." George, chagrined, turned around and marched right back to the dictionary to learn the new word, cursory. That was Mary Carlin in a nutshell. Loved to be have the upper hand in every situation, but she did. She encouraged my dad's love of language big time, and my dad encouraged me too with a love of language. He used to do this thing well into my 30s too, I might add, which was very irritating. If I was with him and we were with people or whatever in conversation, and I would pronounce a word wrong, he would slip me a piece of paper later with the correct pronunciation, like written out like it does in the dictionary, and I would just, I mean, I get it. Dad was trying to protect me and make sure I sounded smart and everything like that. But into your 30s, at some point, you're like, "Dad, I'm just feeling a little, not so great about that." I'd love to just read a little bit of the beginning here of my book, too, just to jump back a little bit. Because there's something about my life that, I don't know, has always felt fated in some way. And I just want to read a little to you a little bit about that. Carlin legend holds that all it took for me to come into the world was a little sperm, a little egg, a little scotch, a little weed, and something called the limbo. We'd been trying to get pregnant for months, but no luck, explained my mom to me, 7-year-old Kelly, as I sat on the bed watching my dad pack for the road. Just moments earlier, he said to me, when I'm down in New Orleans, I'll get a postcard from the hotel you were conceived in and send it to you. Confused by the word conceived, I looked at my mom and she quickly filled in the details. Well, you see, we were down in New Orleans, must have been what, October 62? We were at a club hanging out with some musicians we'd met when someone announced a limbo contest. Well, it sounded like fun, and so I did it. Next thing I knew, I was pregnant. Mom didn't mention the weed or scotch in her telling of my fateful beginning because she didn't need to. They were a given. Oh, sorry about that. They were a given. Dad had been smoking weed and drinking beer since he was 14, and Mom started sneaking sips off her daddy's drinks at around the same age. And as far as the limbo goes, I'm still not clear about the mechanics of it all, but that's never mattered. It clearly worked. I am here. For the 2 years leading up to the night of the limbo, my mom, Brenda, and my dad, George, had been constant companions, starving artists and comrades in arms, chasing my dad's comedy dreams. They did hell gigs, packed and unpacked their suitcases hundreds of times, and traveled to almost every state in the country in their 57 Dodge Dart. My mom loved playing the role of on-the-road partner in crime to my dad's rebel artist on a mission. She was dad's lover, party girl, and press agent, all rolled into one. His full partner in life, and always his best audience. You could always hear her great laugh above the din of clinking glasses and mumbling patrons in every club they visited. Because dad was a complete unknown, on some nights, she was the only person in the audience. One night in Baltimore, no one was in the audience. Not even my mom. My dad asked the club owner, so exactly why am I going on? 'Cause, you know, if people come in, I want them to know we got some entertainment. I hear dad killed that night. During those lean years, dad paid his dues, but also got lucky. One night, Lenny Bruce caught his act in Chicago, loved what he saw, and introduced him to his manager, Murray Becker. This was huge. My dad worshipped Lenny. Taking every opportunity to soak up Lenny's presence, my mom and dad would drive from New York to the Gaeta Horn Club in Chicago just to see him perform. One night while they were there, Lenny got arrested halfway through his set. This had become the norm. That night, the cops did not like the use of his word. I'll not say that because we're doing TV here. It's a very descriptive word. Looking to hassle the club, the cops began to ask everyone for their IDs. When they got to my dad, he defiantly told them, yeah, I don't believe in identification. And the cops promptly threw him into the back of the paddy wagon with Lenny. When my dad proudly told Lenny what he had done, Lenny looked at him and said, what are you, a schmuck? My mom chased that paddy wagon by foot all the way to the police station that night and bailed them out of jail. Growing up surrounded by stories like these and living through many others myself, I've always felt as if my family's journey has unfolded like some kind of mythological legend. Our lives together have felt shaped by a force, threads of fate, or maybe even what my dad called the big electron. Something was calling us forth and interweaving exactly the right people, places, and things to form one amazing life together. It's just always seemed so destined. So maybe we should talk a little bit about the First Amendment.
What? Well, I do want to do, we could talk about that now, or we could, I also want to talk about sort of the next phase after your conception.
Uh-huh.
One of the things I love about, and so I definitely will talk about First Amendment, particularly how we met. I want to share that anecdote. But one of the things I really love about your book is did you spend some time in the titles?
The chapters?
Yeah, the
oh,
various,
sure,
the
of
chapter
course.
Titles.
Yeah.
And one of the, I think, really enlightening ones in terms of your youth is the Three Musketeers, the chapter title, The Three Musketeers, and sort of that part of your life.
Yeah.
And I thought if you could share a little bit
sure.
about that.
Sure, absolutely. So because I was an only child, there were only three of us. And early on, at some point, my dad began calling us the Three Musketeers, all for one, one for all. And that became a real theme. Well, I mean, you know, when you're an only child and you have a tight-knit family like that, you feel like it's sometimes like the three of you just kind of against the you against the world kind of a thing. And it felt like that sometimes, certainly in our lives, especially in the 70s when my dad was considered a hippie freak and it felt like the whole world was against us on some level. But this also became a theme in our life in a sense that... you know, if you grow up in a dysfunctional family, and I'm sure none of you here understand what I'm talking about, there's a sense of loyalty to your family that happens, and there's a willingness to keep your family secrets for your family, to keep them protected, to because you love them, because it's the right thing to do in the moment, because you want to protect your family's reputation, and you don't want to tell strangers what's going on at your house. And so there's a sense of that in my family of, you know, when you grow up, and there was some crazy stuff going on in our household. And I'm just looking here for a little bit of this sense of the Three Musketeers. You know, it was a great sense of belonging in that way, and yet it also kept our alcoholic family's secrets secret, and I don't think helped us in the long run. A lot of crazy stuff went on in my house around that, and but there's a warmth to it that I do love and adore. And actually, I went to my book launch, the Barnes & Noble in L.A., someone came to me and gave me a little Hot Wheels car that had the Three Musketeers on it, little Three Musketeers car. And I it's on my like, you know, my little altar. I just so covet it so much. But I'd like to give a little read here a little bit about kind of what us what we Carlins were doing in the summer of 1972 to give you an idea of how important it was to be the Three Musketeers. In the summer of 1972, Mom and I went on the road with Dad. The road was always a fun adventure. Some of my earliest memories from the road are of waking up in a hotel room with both my parents dead to the world and spending the next few hours coloring, watching cartoons with the volume all the way down and staring out the window at the city below. Finally, when I was starving, I'd nudge my parents awake. Dad would run down to a local diner or store, or as he got more successful, order room service, and buy a bunch of those mini boxes of Rice Krispies and a quart of milk. He'd then carefully take out his pocket knife, cut open those teeny boxes, and magically transform them into an instant bowl. Abracadabra, breakfast was served. And although I'd never heard it, I'm absolutely sure that it was one of those mornings that my dad heard that famous snap, crackle, you. Our first stop that summer was Kent State. My dad took me to the memorial for the four college kids that had been shot by the National Guard a few years before. He explained that they'd been protesting against the war, standing up for what they believed in, and that the government had silenced them by shooting them. This was one of those daddy's big teaching moments. He wanted me to understand the importance of people standing up for what they believed in, especially those who were willing to stand up for their government to make their point. He explained how the government had always silenced those who did not have a voice to begin with, blacks and Native Americans especially, and how young white American girls and boys were now in that category too. I felt there was no safe place for anyone. Being a 9-year-old only child and one who felt an increasing need to be more mature than my years, I acted as calm and cool and collected as I could. I tried to show my dad that I understood the lessons of civics and morality that he was trying to teach me, but it was just a calm veneer, because all I could think was, if the government was shooting these people for standing up for what they believed in, would they shoot me or even my dad? It was a terrifying thought that now echoed in the back of my mind. The next stop on our Summer of 72 tour was Summerfest in Milwaukee. Summerfest is basically an ocean of beer surrounding an island of sausage. You know, what they call good, clean American fun. And you know, when I think good, clean American fun, don't you also immediately think George Carlin? Dad opened for Arlo Guthrie and struggled to do his new material while connecting with the enormous audience of over 10,000 people. He began to do his new routine, the 7 words you can never say on television, which he just recorded on his 3rd album, Class Clown. The album wouldn't be released for another few months, so I'm pretty sure the promoter didn't know exactly what he had signed up for when he booked my dad. The routine was both hilarious and an intellectual examination of the usage of language in our culture. However, it consisted of words, according to my dad, quote, that'll infect your soul, curve your spine, and keep the country from winning the war. And the 7 dirty words are, you know what they are. You want me to say them?
Shit, by the book.
Shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits. Some poor woman outside of Charlottesville watching this live just had a stroke. I apologize to her family now. Okay, good. Yes, she has. Yes, those words. Because Summerfest was an outdoor venue, the main stage act could be heard throughout the fairgrounds, meaning it could be heard by lots of mommies and daddies and little kitties. So there was my dad on stage, killing. Most of the audience was loving it, while Mom and I stood in the wings, also enjoying the show. That's when the promoter rushed up to my mom and said, look, the cops are here. They're complaining about the language, and they're going to arrest George the minute he gets off stage. I guess when my dad said that he'd like to everyone in the audience, the nice Midwestern policeman took some offense at that. Knowing that he was carrying drugs in his pockets, both grass and coke, my mom knew that she had to think fast. She grabbed a glass of water and walked out onto the stage. Dad was very confused, but took the water, and Mom whispered to him, exit stage left. The cops are here. Dad wrapped it up, exited stage left, and we all quickly hustled into the dressing room and locked the door. I anxiously watched as Mom removed a rather large baggie of cocaine from her purse and stashed it in a bass drum. And Dad took out the joint and small vial of coke from his pockets and handed them to the promoter. The promoter was trying to keep things calm when suddenly there was a bang! It sounded as if a gun had gone off. I leapt into my mother's arms and began crying hysterically. As she tried to calm me down, nothing else happened. Someone said, it was probably just a balloon. Someone had popped a balloon. Mom, Dad, and the promoter all laughed a nervous laugh. But I was now unhinged. Terror streaked through my body. I couldn't breathe. I felt like I was going to die. And that's when the door opened, my dad walked out, and within a few seconds, policemen cuffed him. I screamed, Daddy! I was sure that I would never, ever see him again. Mom held me back as I cried. I don't know how long it took, but she finally calmed me down, enough so that she could leave to get my dad out of jail. Luckily, my mom knew exactly what to do because of Lenny Bruce's arrest in Chicago in 1961. You get a civil rights attorney. I went home with the promoter to his house and family, where I spent the rest of the weekend distracting myself by swimming with kids in something that, as a Southern California girl, I had never seen before an above-ground pool. I almost didn't know what to do with it.
I'm just thinking of the irony of when this show gets broadcast about seven words you can't say on television. And it, the irony, of course, is the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression sponsoring a program.
Yeah.
And then the seven dirty words are boop, 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 beeped out.
Well, maybe it'll be a nice education moment for the public.
But it'll also prove the truth that there are seven words you can't say on television.
Even on cable, I guess, or basic cable, I guess it is.
Well, that's actually a choice that can be made, because technically, and this is the focus of the First Amendment case in which your father's routine, seven words you can't say on television, was the focus.
If yes.
You're all, for those of you who don't know, there's a very important First Amendment case which involved this routine, which was played on the radio. And basically it set up, the Supreme Court came up with a new exception to free speech if it's on broadcast spectrum, saying that the government has greater control, has a greater discretion to regulate the content if it's something that's broadcast over the broadcast spectrum. I won't go into the details as to what that reasoning is, but his routine in terms of showing the arbitrariness, I think, of being able to regulate what's called indecent speech, which
right.
could not be regulated.
It wasn't obscene.
In other contexts. It wasn't obscene.
So that was, it was a new category of speech that had been created, this indecent speech, when he was proud
that's
of
right.
that. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask about that. How did he feel about the fact that his routine, and technically, I guess in some ways you could say it proved his point, but in another way, I mean, the free speech side lost.
Yes, they did.
And how did your father feel about that decision?
Well, you know, he always called it an accident of history that he was involved in the case. He never felt like he didn't play the album. WBAI in New York played the album, and it was in the middle of afternoon. The way my dad describes the moment is a professional moralist was in a car with his 14-year-old son when they played the seven dirty words. Like, this 14-year-old son had never heard these words. And of course, my dad's argument was, there are two buttons on a radio, the off mm-hmm. switch and the one that changes the station. If you don't like the speech, choose some different speech. But this gentleman decided to go and complain to the FCC. This thing ended up all the way in the Supreme Court. My dad's biggest joy around this case was that all nine justices had to listen to the album, to the piece that was played, the seven dirty words, and that the actual routine is in the books of the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Right now, you can go to your local law library and look up the case, and his routine is typed out for everyone to see forever. He took great, great pride in that. But he always did feel it was an accident of history. So at 25, I went back to UCLA to get my bachelor's. I became a communications major. And one of the classes we were required to take was a First Amendment class, which was my favorite class. Loved it. Almost became a First Amendment lawyer. Like, was very close. Then I thought, oh, law school. Ugh. But my professor, I'm in a classroom of about 100, 150, you know, maybe a little bigger than this, kind of a size classroom. And my professor, first day of class, was talking about the class and how he loved teaching. And his name's Jeff Cowan. He ran the Annenberg School at USC and knew Clinton, a big First Amendment guy. And he says, my favorite thing about teaching this class is that we'll study the Pacifica versus FCC case, and I'll get to do George Carlin's seven dirty words for you. Now, this has become like a regular occurrence in my life, where I'm like somewhere innocently minding my own business, and my father intrudes on my life. And it was really one of those moments where I saw, so this was in 80, it's about 90, and I really saw, like, wow, my dad's really had this incredible impact on the culture at large. And the fun part was getting to go up to the professor afterwards and going, hi, just want to let you know. And of course, so the professor said to me, oh, could your dad come? Would he come and do the seven dirty words for us? So I went to my dad and I said, so I'm taking this class. And I explained the whole thing to him. And I said, we're studying the Pacifica case. And you know, professor, we'd really love for you to come. And my dad was so, so cute and interesting. His reaction to that was, oh, no, I couldn't do that. I don't know anything about the case. I mean, it's just an accident of history that it was me and blah, 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 blah. And he's going on and on about it. And I just look at him and I'm like, Dad, I don't think they're asking you to know the law. I think they want you to come and be George Carlin and say the seven dirty words. But he was just so darling about it. And so, and I mean, that was really, it really shows my father's kind of humility. My father had a lot of humility about his place in the culture and what he did. And, you know, he really walked that walk, big time. And I don't even think it was until probably just a few years before he died that he even was acknowledging that he was kind of an elder statesman in the world of comedy, and that, you know, he would say things like, well, yeah, when they talk about comedy in the second half of the 20th century, they're going to have to mention me. And I'm like, really, Dad? You think so? So I just I love that about my dad. That's a side of him. I mean, that's another reason I wrote this book, is that my father, everyone knows the version of my father on stage. And if you followed his career over 40 some odd years, you saw very different versions of him on the stage, from the clean cut guy who did the Ed Sullivan and the early Carson shows, hippy dippy weatherman, Indian sergeant guy. Then boom, all of a sudden he's dropped acid and he's got a beard and long hair and he's saying the seven dirty words. And then kind of in the 80s, he's kind of floundering a little bit. And then late 80s, early 90s, he comes out with Jammin' in New York, and he's got a whole nother level of political point of view and outrage about the planet, and which came from him being a brokenhearted idealist. He voted in 72 for McGovern, and when McGovern lost, he never voted again. He believed that the system was broken. And that's why he used to say to people, you know, I don't vote, that way I have a right to complain. I do vote, by the way, and I encourage people to vote. But I forgot my train of thought. The evolution of my dad and him growing, and oh, I have no idea where I was going. Middle age.
Well, it's interesting that your father was so humble about this, but every time I hear comedians, or at least the comedians that I really enjoy being interviewed themselves and talking about their influence, your father's always up there.
Sure.
It's always
him, you know, and Richard are the
Richard
two big
Pryor,
ones.
Richard Pryor,
yeah,
your
Bill
father,
Cosby, Lenny Bruce.
But people like John Stewart, Louis Black, Bill Maher,
yeah.
All these folks always name your father as the person who was most influential. And it's your father lived long enough to know that he had been awarded the Mark Twain Prize for Comedy by the Kennedy Center,
yeah.
But unfortunately did not live long enough to see or attend the actual
ceremony. Yeah, yeah,
right?
He was actually thrilled about that. You know, he didn't really take a lot of, you know, stock in awards and things like that. But when he heard he got the Mark Twain, he was happy about that. And of course, I had been secretly nominating him for years. Like, come on, Mark Twain. I mean, come on, people. George Carlin. If there's not a Mark Twain in our culture, I mean, you know, and they pick some other people who, I get it, it's a TV show and it's the Kennedy Center and stuff like that. But, you know, and I'm a big fan of Billy Crystal. But really, you're picking Billy Crystal before George Carlin for the Mark Twain Prize? You know, so... yeah, he did. He did know that. And, he really did appreciate it. He loved it.
Well, when your father passed away, and this is the story about how we met, I was a big fan of George Carlin. And since he was so associated with the First Amendment, both because of his case and a number of other routines that he had done, we immediately posted on the Thomas Jefferson website, sort of a tribute to George Carlin. Unbeknownst to me, Kelly Carlin, at George Carlin's funeral, there were two organizations that were that suggested that you might want to donate to these organizations in lieu of flowers or tributes. One was the American Heart Association, which makes sense, but the other was the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression, which I had no idea that George Carlin, here's what's behind the scenes. I had no idea that George Carlin had ever heard of us, and maybe he didn't. But I got a phone call, and our administrative assistant put it through and said, Kelly Carlin is on the phone. And I didn't know your name at the time. And you, I picked up the phone, and you introduced yourself as George Carlin's daughter.
And I called him because I wanted to let him know, if you get some donations in my dad's name, I want you to know why. Because I've decided that you're the organization that I'm going to tell people to donate to.
Well, apparently, those Kelly, your father was a big believer in the underdog. Or
yes,
the
and that's why I picked you guys. Yes, you could have picked ACLU or Penn or all great organizations, but my dad was always loved the underdog, and I thought, oh, here's a nice little organization.
What you told me also was that you looked it up. You're looking up researching organizations, and you popped at the Thomas Jefferson Center, and because we just posted it, there was a photo of your dad right there.
The synchronicity in that was too much. I was like, I got to honor that.
This is fate. This is fate.
Yeah, these people are good.
Well, once I realized it wasn't a friend putting me on, you know, that I'm George Carlin's daughter, I was just so excited. I was so thrilled and so honored. And then, typical of me, sort of going too far and putting my foot in my mouth, I said, gosh, I can't tell you what a great day this is. This is like 2 days after her father had passed away and she's grinning. But then I knew it was George Carlin's daughter when I went, oh, God, I realize what I just said. And I hear this laughter on the other end of the line that you appreciated, and you said your father would have appreciated that moment.
Absolutely.
But you obviously share, for one of the things, you share your father's commitment.
Dark humor.
That too. And maybe in that there lies the first event. But your concern about censorship and people, the government telling you what you can and can't say.
I think that that class I took at UCLA really taught me a great understanding about, well, constitutional law in general, but the first, I mean, obviously watching my father get arrested for saying the 7 dirty words and hearing Lenny Bruce's story all the time your whole life, you're a person who's interested in language and censorship. I think the thing that is most important, I mean, it is the First Amendment. Like, that's a little hint right there. It's not the 6th, it's the first one. And, you know, when I got to learn that we had to argue cases on both sides, as you have to do in law school also, and we had to argue both sides of the argument in these First Amendment cases in this class. And I really learned that even though I don't agree with your speech, I will fight for the right for you to parade down, you know, if it's like the KKK in Skokie, Illinois, a famous case, you know, it's like, and here we are in America in 2016 dealing with this issue all over again. And it's great because I think it's a great teaching moment for our country to talk about speech and what is illegal speech and legal speech and hate speech and inciting violence and all sorts of things. So it's a really essential conversation that we need to be having as citizens, and all citizens should really understand their constitution and all the arguments involved in it. I want to be prescient of time here, and I know we have a clip of my dad, and so I wanted to set up the clip.
Sure.
So this is later in my dad's life. This is 2006. It's a few years before he died. And then we're going to, it'll lead right into this clip that we're going to play here. Bob is the name of my husband. In November 2005, Bob and I flew to New York to see my dad shoot his 13th HBO special, Life is Worth Losing. I was excited. My dad rarely let me glimpse his new material before he shot it for HBO. He liked having me experience the material in its full and polished form. It was always a thrill for me to sit in the audience not knowing what was coming. This year, I was especially looking forward to seeing him. We'd both been really busy, and we hadn't seen each other in about 3 months. After walking up the stairs backstage at the Beacon Theater, I caught my breath and walked into his dressing room. I saw a short, white-haired man with his back to me. When he turned around, it was my dad. I was stunned. Who took my father and left this elderly man in his place? My dad's face was puffy, he was 2 inches shorter, and he looked like he was fighting to breathe. What the hell? I noticed the last few times I talked with him on the phone that he'd been a bit scatterbrained, very unlike my dad. He'd forgotten the name of his assistant once, and one day he didn't show up at a breakfast we'd planned. I thought at the time it must be his age, but seeing him now backstage, I knew something was really wrong. People don't age this quickly. I didn't say anything to him, not wanting to distract him from the task ahead that night. But as I walked to my seat in the audience, I worried if he'd be able to make it through the show. I steeled myself for the worst. Would he be okay? Would the audience respond to how he looked? Might he even collapse? But when he took the stage that night, he came alive. And all I could think was, if he could just stay there, he just might live forever. Could you play the clip? Oh, you're going to play it here?
Oh, yeah, this is dangerous. They put me in charge of this. But,
there you go. But
that he passed on, he got from his mother and passed on to his daughter. And that's not it. I thought that.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm a modern man, a man for the millennium, digital and smoke-free, a diversified, multicultural, postmodern deconstructionist, politically, anatomically, and ecologically incorrect. I've been uplinked and downloaded, I've been inputted and outsourced, I know the upside of downsizing, I know the downside of upgrading. I'm a high-tech lowlife, a cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, bi-coastal multitasker, and I can give you a gigabyte in a nanosecond. I'm new wave, but I'm old school, and my inner child is outward bound. I'm a hot-wired, heat-seeking, warm-hearted, cool customer, voice-activated and biodegradable. I interface with my database is in cyberspace, so I'm interactive, I'm hyperactive, and from time to time, I'm radioactive. Behind the eight ball, ahead of the curve, riding the wave, dodging the bullet, pushing the envelope. I'm on point, on task, on message, and off drugs. I got no need for coke and speed. I got no urge to binge and purge. I'm in the moment, on the edge, over the top, but under the radar. A high-concept, low-profile, medium-range ballistic missionary. A streetwise smart bomb. A top gun bottom feeder. I wear power ties, I tell power lies, I take power naps, I run victory laps. I'm a totally ongoing Bigfoot slam dunk rainmaker with a proactive outreach. A raging workaholic. A working rageaholic. Out of rehab and in denial. I got a personal trainer, a personal shopper, a personal assistant, and a personal agenda. You can't shut me up. You can't dumb me down because I'm tireless and I'm wireless. I'm an alpha male on beta blockers. I'm a non-believer and an overachiever, laid back but fashion forward, up front, down home, low rent, high maintenance, supersized, long-lasting, high-definition, fast-acting, oven-ready, and built to last. I'm a hands-on, foot-loose, knee-jerk head case, prematurely post-traumatic, and I have a love child who sends me hate mail. But I'm feeling, I'm caring, I'm healing, I'm sharing. A supportive, bonding, nurturing primary caregiver. My output is down, but my income is up. I take a short position on the long bond, and my revenue stream has its own cash flow. I read junk mail, I eat junk food, I buy junk bonds, I watch trash sports. I'm gender-specific, capital-intensive, user-friendly, and lactose-intolerant. I like rough sex. I like rough sex. I like tough love. I use the F word in my email, and the software on my hard drive is hardcore, no soft porn. I bought a microwave at a mini mall. I bought a minivan at a megastore. I eat fast food in the slow lane. I'm toll-free, bite-sized, ready-to-wear, and I come in all sizes. A fully equipped, factory-authorized, hospital-tested, clinically proven, scientifically formulated medical miracle. I've been pre-washed, pre-cooked, pre-heated, pre-screened, pre-approved, pre-packaged, post-dated, freeze-dried, double-wrapped, vacuum-packed, and I have an unlimited broadband capacity. I'm a rude dude, but I'm the real deal. Lean and mean, cocked, locked, and ready to rock. Rough, tough, and hard to bluff. I take it slow, I go with the flow, I ride with the tide, I got glide in my stride. Driving and moving, sailing and spinning, jiving and grooving, wailing and winning. I don't snooze, so I don't lose. I keep the pedal to the metal and the rubber on the road. I party hardy, and lunchtime is crunch time. I'm hanging in, there ain't no doubt, and I'm hanging tough over and out.
I just want to read this one little bit that comes right after this. So a month after this, he really couldn't breathe. Christmas Eve morning, Sally called. Kelly, we're at Cedars Sinai Hospital. George is in the emergency room. Bob and I raced north on La Cienega Boulevard and found Sally in the waiting room, my dad's girlfriend, shaken up. They've stabilized him. He's doing better. About 20 minutes later, the ER doctor came out. He's doing much better than when he came in. We gave him some medicine, Lasix, to help remove some of the fluid from his lungs and stabilize the heart failure. The what? Heart failure. That's what had been going on with him in New York. Heart failure. It is a condition they could stabilize with medicine for a few years, but eventually only a heart transplant would fix it permanently. After a while, they let me see him. As I sat alone with him in the emergency room, he admitted to me that he'd had symptoms for months and months and had ignored them so that he could do his HBO special. I wanted to kill him. But on the other hand, I got it. It was a great show. As he lay there dozing, I sat at the foot of his bed with my hands on his feet, meditating and sending him as much life force as I could. I was doing my best to uphold my shaman duties. My dad called me the shaman of the family. I'd never felt so peaceful in his presence before. There was a sweetness to it. A week later, they released him from the hospital, but now he'd had a device implanted in his chest. It was a combination pacemaker, heart pump, and defibrillator. Dad was oddly proud of this device because he bragged, "It's the exact same device they implanted in the chest of Dick Cheney." my dad died a few years later, and there's the ending of the book. I don't want to give it away, but we had a great chance to heal and come together. I mean, we had already healed a lot of our past and stuff, but just an amazing ending happened for us, one that fits well with the beginning of our story. It feels almost like a mythological legend in some ways, and so I feel very lucky and full of a lot of gratitude that I got to heal with my parents, and we got to love each other and laugh with each other through all of the insanity and the roller coaster ride of our lives. And I'm so honored to be able to tell my story to everyone and to share pieces of my dad that people don't get otherwise. I think that was the point I wanted to make earlier, that part of the reason I wanted to write this book was they see one version of my dad on stage, that guy, but they don't know the husband and the father and the man and the artist, the struggling artist. And it's just a great privilege to be able to share that part of my dad with the world. So if you guys have any questions, we'd love to take some questions.
Yes, ma'am. Can we bring the mic to this one? Can you hold on?
They want that for
the they'll be recording. Just wait 1 second.
TV.
They'll bring you over
TV.
Here.
TV.
I'll just say one thing as the microphone is making its round. One of the things I really enjoy about this book is learning a lot more about George Carlin. But even if you don't know anything about George Carlin, this is a wonderful book to read for all of the other aspects of your story. But not just about you, but your mother is a fascinating character.
Yeah, I wanted to give my mother voice.
I'd like to talk about. Yeah. I wish we had time to talk about the influence that she had on you and what she her survivor story.
Yeah, truly.
And it's always fun to learn and see from a different perspective somebody you think you know, but then you see an entirely different aspect of George Carlin's life and character from reading this book, but also just this whole story of this unique story, your story.
Yeah,
and it's just a very, very enlightening and also very entertaining read. So I strongly
they call
endorse,
it a page turner. I don't know.
Strongly.
I leave little cliffhangers at the end of each chapter. Oh, you must go to the next chapter now.
Well, I'll just tell you what Bill Maher says. One hell of a ride. Kelly Carlin gives great insight into a man who was a hero to many, but a father to one. And it really is just a wonderful, wonderful read. So I strongly encourage everybody to buy a copy if they'd like. His paperback is coming out soon if you want
September.
To wait. But I've always been a big influence in terms of what people choose to buy and read. But from if you take the advice of complete strangers, that's probably not a good idea. But I highly recommend this book. Let's turn to
you have a question.
Now. Yes.
What do you think your father would make of today's political situation?
Shocking, I got that question. I get that question 10 times a day on Twitter. Well, first of all, he'd love it. He'd absolutely love it. Here's what I say to people. I say, look, this is what my dad said. He said, when you're born, you get a ticket to the freak show. When you're born in America, you get a front row seat. And it feels like this day and age, we're all in the VIP section.
Yeah.
He'd love it. He'd love it. He died June 22nd, 2008. He didn't get to see Obama become president. He was excited, though. He was excited about Hillary being a possibility of first female president. And then Obama started getting some traction right around then, and my dad was excited. When I went to Washington, D.C. to do the Mark Twain Prize, my husband and I went to the Lincoln Memorial, and we were standing on the steps, and the presidential helicopter went over our heads, and it was Obama visiting the White House for the first time. And I cried such tears for my father, because my father was a huge advocate. Having grown up in Harlem and black culture and black music, if you know his earlier Class Clown albums and stuff, he talks about it a lot, Occupation Fool, was a huge influence on him. And he was absolutely just, you know, he would have been thrilled to have seen that happen. So, but nowadays he'd be the show, the spectacle of it all. Yeah. So, you know, I wish he was here to give us the more specifics, because he would have a unique take on it that no one else has come up with. But I feel that we're in, you know, as far as satirical comedy goes, we're still in really good hands. There's a lot of great satirical comics out there who do political work and who are, if you haven't seen Samantha Bee's new Full Frontal show, highly, highly recommend it. I think she's my front runner right now. I love her. Someone else? So,
question right here.
I learned a new expression this week, post-traumatic thriving. And I wonder would share your experience, strength, and hope about post-traumatic thriving.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Yay, let's reframe that. Yeah, there's, you know, I think part of it is, you know, we're kind of lucky with our genetics. We get some thriving genes, some resilience genes. I come from really good stock. And there's something about love. I was really lucky to know that no matter all the chaos in my life, in my childhood, especially from age 5 to 12, I knew I was loved, deeply loved. And there's something about that early childhood attachment theory they talk about that is real. So I knew I was ultimately safe. It took me a while to ultimately figure that out as an adult. I mean, I did have panic attack syndrome and agoraphobia for 10 years. But there is something about that. And at some point in all of our healing process, you need to move from and it's important to feel your pain, to feel your rage, to feel the place of victimhood that you are, because you were a child, you have completely powerless, into, okay, now what? That's a really important shift in a life and in a healing. And because it's ultimately, it is our life and we're adults and we have to take responsibility for it. And I had to learn to take responsibility for my anxiety and my depression and my life and what I was going to do with it. And it was terrifying and confusing, but it's the only thing that really saved my life ultimately. So thank you for that question.
Question?
Hello.
Hi, Kelly. I'm Wendy Edwards with News Radio 1070 WINA and 98.9 FM. And my question for you is, when it comes to dad-isms that, especially in your teenage years, made you like roll your eyes and groan like, "Dad, are you saying this to me again?" What would that be?
That would probably be the correcting of my pronunciation and stuff like that. I mean, my dad was the coolest dad ever. I mean, hello. When I was in high school, we shared weed. Kind of hard to roll your eyes at that kind of a dad. You know, and I think my parents were that first generation where it was really confusing for parents because they had partied a lot and they didn't quite know how to, and they didn't buy into the just say no campaign. And it was actually before that I was in high school. I was in high school in the late 70s. So they really couldn't put their foot down and say, "Oh, rah, 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 rah." Do I wish they had a little bit more? Yeah. Wish they'd created more limits for me and more rules. Probably would have saved me 10 years of my life in my 20s. But once again, they didn't, and I had to learn from that. But yeah, my dad was a god to me, you know, and is still a god to a lot of people. I've had to learn to take him off the pedestal and realize he's human. But yeah, I think for the most part, it was that kind of his, you know, wanting to control my speech, which is so ironic.
Sure, right here.
So, first of all, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you
very much for writing this book and sharing insights into someone that I know many of us in here miss desperately.
Yes.
In the Seaville this week, there was a blurb on this particular session, and there was a comment about George's commitment to truth.
Yes.
In everything he said. And one of my earliest memories of George Carlin was his description of a tomato, which I thought was just so dead on truthful.
I barely eat them still because of that description.
Can you talk about, you know, that aspect, the truth and honesty?
Beautiful. I would love to. It's something we actually didn't get a chance to talk about here. It's another big theme of my book. First of all, the description of the tomato that he's talking about, if you don't know it, is my dad considered it a food that was not finished. It was still undone, had not finished developing. My other favorite food thing was he never ate anything that he had to break into its house to eat, like a clam or something like that. I love that. I don't eat clams or oysters because of that. He was very influential in my life. One of the ironies of the Carlin household and one of the themes of this book is truth-telling. And my father was the truth teller to quite a few generations. But growing up in an alcoholic, drug addicted, dysfunctional household, truth is a slippery slope. And it was confusing for me as a kid because with dysfunction comes denial. And denial is about ignoring the truth, the big elephant in the room. And so insane things would go on in my life. A very famous story I tell is my father waking me up one morning. This was in the mid-70s. And we'd just been to Hawaii on a Hawaiian vacation. My dad came into my room and woke me up and said, "Kelly, I need you to wake up. I think the sun has exploded and we have about 7 minutes to live." And my father had been up for about 5 days doing a lot of coke, and he was hallucinating, and he was screwed up. And we went outside, and it was kind of hazy, weird sun and stuff. But anyway, my point is that I couldn't go to school on Monday, and when I was asked about Easter vacation, how it was, I couldn't say, "Well, my dad's freaking out on drugs, and my mom and dad almost tried to kill each other with knives." And, you know, I couldn't speak the truth. So I had this very difficult relationship with learning what my truth was and how to express myself, my emotions, and reality. There wasn't a lot of reality going on. I was living a parallel life. That's when I started living a parallel life, which is my persona and then my private life. And that got me into a lot of trouble when I got into an abusive relationship, because I didn't tell anyone about it for 2 years in high school. It got me into trouble when I was doing way too much cocaine and knew I needed help. It got me into trouble when I was agoraphobia and I couldn't get in my car and drive around and couldn't explain to people why I was no longer leaving my house. So, you know, it's a very delicate thing. And one of the things that happened with my dad and I was that I, in 99, had written a one-woman show because I wanted to talk about my mother and her death and how it had transformed me. And part of it was I wanted to talk about my childhood and how that was a part of shaping me. And how difficult that was for my dad when I said, I want to do this show. And he part of it was difficult because I talked about things in the show that I'd never actually talked to my dad about before. Feelings I had about some things that had gone on. And he said to me, like, well, why did I have to read your script to find out about this? And I said, well, maybe I felt like I had to be on your stage for you to finally hear me. Truth. So that's something my dad and I, that it was a healing my dad and I had in our life, was we got to actually talk to each other and learn to share the scary things inside of us that all of us humans go through and share our feelings. Truth is interesting. It is relative at times.
How do you think you, just for your information, sorry to butt in back in the questioning, but you've also done a one-woman show.
Yeah, I'm doing a solo show now that I tour a little bit, yeah.
Which I was fortunate enough to see in Los Angeles, and it's really a parallel to this book.
Yeah, it's the scaffolding for this book.
Right.
This book's much more in-depth, but yeah, there's a lot there.
How do you think your father would feel about that show? Because that was written, of course, after his passing.
Yeah,
although it started earlier.
I think that, I think part of my role in the family is to, if he was alive and I was doing it, I mean, first of all, I don't know if that would be possible because mm-hmm. of a lot of what I say in the, there's times in the book where I talk about how I back away from telling my story while he's alive for different reasons. But I really see now that my role in the world as a truth teller, because my dad did teach me to be a truth teller, is to speak my truth and to talk about our shared humanity. And that we're all broken and we're all messed up and we're all just trying to figure it out. And that's why I want to tell my story, because I want people to feel safe to tell their stories, whether it's to their loved ones or on a stage or wherever it is. We're only as sick as our secrets, as they say in AA. And so I think in the end, I think my father would be very proud of me because I have figured out what my role is as a truth teller, and there's nothing daddy dearest in this book at all. Mm-hmm. When this book first came out, some people were like, oh, daddy dearest, trolls on the internet. And I'm like, really? Have you read the book? Do you know anything about it? Mm-hmm. There's so much love in this book. There's not a moment of complaining or victimhood. So, and I think my dad would get, one thing I say in the solo show is that, when people come to see my show or read my book, they always love my dad so much more than they used to, because now he's a whole person to them. And only once at a speaking gig had a guy come up to me and say, oh, I got to tell you, I've lost respect for your dad now that I know that he couldn't function that well as a human and stuff. And I was like, wow, dude, that says a lot more about you than it does my dad.
Well, I think the cover photo that you chose for the book just says so much about your relationship. I mean, you can just see it in this picture. It's just,
I'm a daddy's,
even if you
girl.
Don't buy the book, come up and look at this photograph. Next question.
Right here.
Thank you. Yes.
Coming back to your reminding us of what the seven words are that you can't say, I was thinking, I wonder how they're going to subtitle that if someone is running subtitles as they watch the television. But then that led me to thinking about what publications do, where they will take those seven words, and they will print the first letter,
right?
XXX or asterisk.
Like, we don't know what they're saying?
But this is more a First Amendment question than anything else. The question is, what's the point?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What Great. Kind of trouble would a publication, a general purpose publication, get in for actually shocking the world with the full spelling of those seven words?
Well, I'd actually, if you were here, I'd point, I have John Jeffries, former dean of the law school, also a member of the Center's Board of Trustees, professor of law at the law school, answer that question. So I'm very nervous in answering it myself because I'll probably get it wrong. But the fact is, in a publication, that's probably a question of choice by the publication. It would be very difficult under First Amendment law to get in any trouble for, particularly if they're talking about it in this context. But to use those words in a publication or something like that, that would not meet the definition of obscenity. The indecency provision only applies to broadcasting, this lesser protecting of speech. So it's basically an area of law. It's not the actual content. A big part of the definition is where it's being done. And in fact, here's where I think I'm right, John. But the words that we said here, when you see The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and they bleep those words out, or cable television or satellite television, that's really a question of choice, the choice of the people who are producing the show. It's not a requirement, because those shows aren't presented to you via the broadcast spectrum. I won't go too much into the weeds as to why the government has that greater control, but it's an interesting development, because I don't think any of us today think about, oh, this is a cable access television show as opposed to NBC access television show.
Right.
But that is, therein lies the difference as to why the government can have greater control over broadcast spectrum, and that indecency provision only as a matter of law applies if it is on the broadcast spectrum. John, is that correct?
and what always gets me about this, when you read the word, well, you're reading the word is being said in your head, so it's not like you're going, wow, I wonder what that word is. Maybe it's spot.
You know,
or fork. You know, it's just so silly.
Well, we were just talking about this. There's a television show on recently, a few years ago, Battlestar Galactica, which was took place, you know, it's humanoid beings, but in another universe. The way they got around this was they created their own curse words and their own indecent words. And the word was fracking. Now, just imagine another word.
Now, that is an indecent word.
Now, imagine a word that begins with F that many of us might be offended by, but just used liberally. Oh, I don't give a frack. Why don't you go frack yourself?
That's so
brilliant. All of this.
I
mean, they just completely, because it was a different culture.
That's great.
The other thing interesting about your thing is in Virginia Beach, there's an ordinance, which I think is incredibly unconstitutional, local ordinance, but that you can't curse in public. There are
what?
More of these than you think. Yeah, yeah. And it's still on the books.
Let's go test it.
But it does. But on street signs in Virginia, there's the exactly the kind of thing you see, where you see the little like asterisk and pound sign for cuss words and stuff, only they're all put up there, and then there's a red circle with a line through it, and it's posted. Go walk down Virginia Beach and in the streets, and you'll see those signs there. And people are fined for those, for violating that. Next question.
Yes, my friend Cheryl. Yes.
Hello, Kelly.
Hello, darling.
I'm glad you're here. I'm curious, because I actually don't know the answer, is back in the day before paparazzi was as big as it is today,
mm-hmm.
was your family unit ever violated?
No, we were so lucky. We never were. I think because of my dad wasn't part of the pop culture, we never were. The sickest thing about tabloid stuff is that the one time we showed up there is when my mother was dying of liver cancer. And we were in the National Enquirer for that. And I was just like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, just horrific. But no, we're very lucky, very lucky, that in my teenage years, there was nothing like that really around yet. I was hanging out. I went to school in L.A. with all sorts of celebrities' kids, and we were doing a lot of illegal things, a lot of drugs and stuff, and just crazy teenage stuff. And thank God we weren't it's not like the Kardashians or anything. And thank God there was no Facebook. But yeah, we were always very protected. And, really back in the day, like when we knew each other, Cheryl's a friend of mine from Venice. We lived there in the early 70s together. During that time, what was really dangerous was the cops. I mean, you know, was more dangerous in our family than anything, was feeling like my dad could be arrested at any moment, because he usually was going to be. But yeah, I'm really glad there wasn't. Thank God. Anyone else?
Yeah. Hi,
yes.
Kelly.
Hi, Kiva.
Yesterday we did a great podcast, and I'm with the Thomas Jefferson Center as well. And Kelly came on and discussed a lot of things that you didn't hear today. So if you want to go listen to it, it's the Muzzled podcast. But one of the things that I think fascinated me the most was the response both of his fans after his death to you, and kind of disparate responses, as well as the response of the comedy community, which you had not before been a part.
Yeah. So before my dad died, I was not... I watch a little bit of comedy. It was my dad's job. And my dad was like, did theaters, so we didn't go to comedy clubs growing up. There were no comedy clubs when I was growing up. It wasn't a thing. So I didn't know a lot of comedians. I think I knew one or two, maybe. And when my dad died, comedians started calling me immediately the next day. And I found myself, you know, sitting on the floor of my bathroom crying into the phone with Gary Shandling one morning. And it was really an incredible thing because the comedy family, a lot of comedians who you talked about, some of them, who really, my dad was like their father, great uncle of comedy. And they all said to me, we're here for you. We know you're alone and we are your family now. And if you ever need anything, please pick up the phone and call us. And so that was an incredible feeling because my dad, you know, was this huge... He was the sun of my solar system, and, you know, here he was gone. And then because social media became a thing that summer, 2008 was really when I got involved in Facebook, and it really became a thing, his fans found me. And the first year and a half or two, I don't know what I would have done without the fans, because they really lifted me up, and they loved me unconditionally, and they took me in. And we shared everything about my dad. I could have conversations with them about them, and we could share his humor and his material and his stuff. And, you know, in some ways I had to eventually grow out of that and walk out of the shadow of that a little bit, but, in order for my sanity, but really I felt like it was like this beautiful web of love and light that had caught me and kept my head just above the water of grief for a few years so that I didn't completely disappear into it. And it's really an interesting thing about grief. As many of you know, it's a very unique process. But now that the book is out, which came out last September, I feel like on some level that I'm done being George Carlin's daughter. I mean, I still am, but that I'm actually able to now have my own time of personal grief, that I don't have to be on display anymore. And even though I do events like this and do my show a little bit, that there's a private space for me now because there's the public thing here. So I've been watching my journey. It's been very fascinating. So we have a few more minutes. Oh, time. We got a time from the tea lady. The tea lady. Okay, we're good. Yeah, I'm gonna sign some books. If someone wants to buy some books, I'll sign them or whatever, and we'll meet and we'll take pictures and selfies. Yes.
Before we cut off.
Yes.
Please fill out an evaluation. I'm told to do
that
again.
Fill out your evaluations,
everyone.
You
can turn your cell phones back on. But the other thing I was gonna say, petition whatever local theater, Paramount or something, to have the play version of this book to sign up to bring this to Charlottesville. It's such an entertaining production.
Thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.